Feminist women.
Mulheres feministas.
زنان فمینیست.
بانیو و چیکونزرو چواکادزی.
نساء.
Mulheres feministas.
Young femini. Femactivist.
Nari Mukti.
Matapang na babae. Kechimae. Ka ishk.
Good afternoon, listeners. I'm Erin Mathewson, and this is Women's Magazine, a weekly program that talks about news and culture from a feminist perspective. This week marks the one-year anniversary of the beginning of the Occupy Wall Street movement. A number of events and actions will be happening in and around the Bay Area to honor the day and keep the momentum of Occupy going. In addition, many participants and spectators alike are evaluating what the movement accomplished and what its future holds. One of our questions has been whether Occupy is actually pushing us toward a new world or just patriarchy as usual. On today's show, Kate Raphael discusses this and other questions about Occupy and how feminist it is with Sin, Caitlin, and Frank of Occupy Oakland's Feminist Queers Against Capitalism and Shaista Hussein of Occupy Wall Street's Safer Spaces and Immigrant Justice Working Groups. We'll return after a short break. Stay with us.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to Women's Magazine. I'm Kate Raphael. Is the Occupy movement a feminist movement? That question has been preoccupying the feminist blogosphere. Occupy Wall Street is galvanizing because the ire is feminist, anti-colonialist, anti-racist, and anti-patriarchal, wrote Daphne Moeller on Ms. Blog. But Lucinda Marshall, co-founder of Occupy Patriarchy, sees a less unified picture. Affordable childcare and unequal paychecks are most certainly economic issues, and reproductive injustice and the commodification of women's bodies in sex trafficking and pornography industries have huge economic ramifications, she writes. Unfortunately, those who seek to address these topics are finding themselves confronting many of the same obstacles that women often face outside of the Occupy movement, such issues as safety, sexism, misogynist power structures, and a lack of gendered analysis. And of course, volumes have been written about the website Hot Chicks of Occupy Wall Street, an honest-to-goddess effort to build the movement by featuring body parts of beautiful women saying highly intelligent things while they bounce up and down.
I kind of feel a sense of pride that our generation has finally started to take some responsibility for the things that happen around us, and I think that if we continue to grow and continue to come together, that we can make some real change in the country. You can call me an idealist, but I don't care how long it takes. This movement's going to continue to grow, and we're not going anywhere. So we'll stay out here until it's done.
I'm originally Egyptian, so this is not new to me, and I'm loving it. Even in Egypt, we're inspired by what's happening here, and we're celebrating.
A few days ago, I sat down to talk about some of these issues with four self-identified feminists who have been very involved in the movement from the beginning. Shaista Hussein is an immigrant from Pakistan who grew up in Hong Kong, Khartoum, and Houston, and lives in New York City with her two sons. Shaista studied transnational feminism and media studies at the City University of New York and has been an activist for free and open admissions and against privatization of education. And she joined the Occupy Wall Street mobilization before the camp began on September 17th. Frank was born and raised in San Francisco and recently returned from New York, where she was studying and doing small-c commie political work. She's been involved in Occupy Oakland almost every day since it started. Sin is originally from Tijuana, Mexico, and moved here to study literature and politics at UC Santa Cruz. She's currently spending a semester at Berkeley and has been involved in Occupy Oakland as much as possible. And Caitlin is a writer, blogger, and radical queer activist, originally from Michigan and now living in Oakland. I just want to mention that we had some technical problems in the studio here when we were recording this interview, so I apologize for that. One of the things about being a volunteer show is that we're usually recording after hours and on weekends, so if the equipment isn't working properly, there's usually nobody around to ask. but you're really going to want to hear what these women have to say, so please stick with us. So let's start with how you each got involved and why you decided to be involved in the Occupy movement. Sin, would you like to start?
Sure. I started with the whole Occupy movement actually in 2009 with the student occupations. Well, I attend UC Santa Cruz, and there was a series of occupations in 2009 that were sort of a reaction to the budget cuts and tuition fee hikes. So naturally, to me, the whole Occupy movement in Oakland and other cities was a perfect way to connect these issues of, you know, the cuts to public education and other sectors of the economy. So that's how I got involved. It started with the student movement for me.
Frank?
I was also involved in the student occupation movement in New York back in those long ago days. I got involved with Occupy Oakland because the initial politics of Occupy Oakland were so good and so rad, and so what I wanted to be a part of. I was in New York briefly for Occupy Wall Street and wasn't galvanized as much there, but here in Oakland, the people who put it together were really amazing, and I'm really glad that I joined.
Jaysta, tell us how you became involved in Occupy Wall Street and a little about the, if you wouldn't mind, a little about the history of that protest.
Well, I was initially inspired in January 25th with the Egyptian Revolution, which was pretty shocking and just the imagery. So, you know, there was a call out in late July for September 17th. I'd gone to some pre-meetings and, you know, general assemblies, but I was very reluctant, and so it wasn't until the Troy Davis execution where the city was really mobilized and it started to really take off, you know. It's interesting because a lot of the early organizers, although there was this call from Adbusters from, you know, Toronto or Canada somewhere, it was more like a Facebook event. It wasn't really grassroots or anything, and I think people just, various people who were needing a venue, a platform, and just started organizing. So at that point, I started meeting a lot more CUNY students, union activists, and people, grassroots community people, and they were just showing up at these meetings, and the General Assemblies were becoming bigger. So that was the early part of the Consensus General Assembly. And I wasn't familiar with the process, so I was very skeptical about it, you know.
One of the things that has been written about a lot and talked about a lot is the process that's being used in the Occupy movements and the General Assemblies. And the media is acting like this is this brand new thing that's never been heard of before. And of course, pretty much every group that I've ever been in since the 70s, you know, has been organized horizontally and has used some form of consensus process. And in fact, back in the 70s and early 80s, we used to call that process feminist process. But somewhere along the line, I also learned that it's not as simple as one set of rules equals feminist, that ultimately you have to look at who is and isn't being empowered by your process. So I'm wondering, because you have all now had quite a lot of experience with using this on a previously almost unheard of scale, what has been your experience in terms of how effective is this process at empowering women, queers, people of color, other marginalized communities? Caitlin?
Yeah. I'm not sure that the process in itself, like, really does particularly empower anyone specifically. It doesn't necessarily address, like, the needs of people who are in, like, marginalized groups. In a lot of ways, it was very business as usual. You had, like, straight white men who were very interested in giving their opinions and were happy to take up as much space as is physically possible. And the process didn't necessarily mean that, like, they, like, couldn't shout people down, that they couldn't take up all that space. The formal process is, I guess, like, what has seemed kind of lackluster or like that seems to have not addressed that. But like within that, there have been people who have addressed stuff.
And Shasta, you're part of the Safer Spaces Working Group in New York, so that implies that there was a certain need for people to step up and introduce some other kinds of processes than came along maybe organically. Can you talk about how that happened?
I joined Safer Spaces when it was already formed because I had actually another woman who thought I was an infiltrator. Or she was kind of threatened by me, and so I went to seek out mediation because I wanted to speak to her. And so I'm pretty sure that Safer Spaces was created pretty early in the process. And one of the things we do have in the General Assembly is a progressive stack. So with the right type of facilitation, underrepresented or marginal voices or someone who hasn't spoken should be a priority, but that it doesn't always work out that way. One of the first issues I had early, before September 17th, was we were using, for outreach, we were using the ballerina image. I think everybody in the world has seen it now. For
us, yeah, that graphic that Eric Drucker did, kind of, I think it's something that was actually done some years ago, I think originally for a group that I was part of called Direct Action to Stop the War, and we critiqued it at that time, let me just say, and that was back in 2003. But yeah, it's like the one dancing across the sky.
I had a slight problem with it because it's not a beautiful aesthetically pleasing image. I just didn't feel it reflected the diversity of New York. And it was alluding to maybe images of opera or classical. And to me, it seemed a bit like American Apparel or something. I didn't mind it. I just felt that we could have something else or more images or a plethora of images. The politics of representation were not taken care of, were not addressed from the beginning, you know? Was kind of on the back burner. It was like, okay, let's just get this up and going. And so obviously later, more and more imagery, more and more posters, more diverse came up. But.
And Sin, you were wanting to say something.
I was just going to say that I don't believe that the process itself empowers people to actually speak up or makes the people who are speaking diverse. You know, in the student movement, we used the same process and we had a lot of problems with power dynamics, and that's actually how I became involved in feminist circles. So I don't think that this process allows for more people to speak or more voices to be heard. I think that what we really need is for groups to form that empower each other. And it's not going to be in the process that we're going to find this.
So how has that gone in terms of the Occupy groups and also other groups that you all may have been involved in before or maybe forming out of that? Because, you know, I think the Occupy movement is in a bit of a time of transition now. And I think one of the questions is, what is it going to transition to? If you could talk some about times when you were maybe having a problem or feeling a need to come together as women, as queers, as transnational people, which two of you are, and how you were able to pull groups together and what it's been like sort of working in those groups within these very large groups.
At Occupy Oakland, pretty much right away, there started to be a lot of issues of harassment of women, people grabbing women, people verbally harassing queer people and trans people. And it was really not dealt with very directly for several days. And the moment that I think it really came together was somebody basically really seriously threatened, verbally harassed and threatened a woman, genderqueer person there. And we basically got a group of people together, a group of feminists together to walk around the camp and look for that person and, like, eject them, which is kind of the process that had been being used to get rid of police in Occupy Oakland. You get a huge group of people and you yell at the cops until they leave if they ever tried to come in. And so we started doing the same kind of thing with people who are sort of sexually harassing people. And it wasn't perfect at all. And, you know, it didn't always work. But I thought that that was like the really appropriate response. There had been a Safer Spaces working group at the time. But the problem was that they were dealing more with, as was kind of mentioned before, mediation issues, which are very important, but actually aren't what is needed in certain kinds of circumstances. So, yeah, I think that, this sort of like direct, like self-organized response to issues of violence went well. There was some also really pointed issues of racism and like racist homophobia that occurred, where there was varying levels of appropriate response that, you know, we all in retrospect wished it had been more of like a collective ejection of the person who was being violent.
Shasta, were you wanting to add something?
Yeah, we also formed from Safer Spaces a community alliance, and it's really tried to send this document through every working group, people of color, the Women's Alliance, Anti-Racist Alliance, Queer Alliance. So we formed this document where everybody could edit, and we also have a peace council process where members from all these different groups form a peace council. And yes, the first, I agree, there is a big emphasis on de-escalation and mediation, but then there is also accountability. And the issue with accountability is, I mean, at a certain point, it's really hard to get a person who has been called out to get long-term mediation or to agree to engage, you know. And then if it's a really violent situation, that person has to be ejected. And at a certain point, if we need to call the police, that has to be done as well, or medical or mental health. You know, later in the occupation, there were a lot of cases of drug abuse, and I was also working in the medic. In New York, what was going on was the police were taking a lot of homeless people, and I mean, a lot of homeless people were coming to the occupation as well, or people who've been ejected from mental health. So at Safer Spaces, we had to call in community groups that can help us work with these issues, because we didn't want to be, again, we had to have a compassionate model. Also, at one point, there were some right-wing, not to be alarmist, but there were right-wing hate groups that were identified by security. And so a lot of people came together from the community to sort of self-police ourselves. So what we find ourselves is that the mainstream media, the police or the NYPD, used all of these issues of violence, of drug abuse, of they took this as a justification or legitimacy to actually close us down.
Yeah, as if they're like so concerned about sexual assault and sexual harassment, like so.
Right. I mean, in Oakland, they actually, I don't remember reading where, but that's what was really troubling to them, that people were actually self-policing themselves. That was a justification for going in as well. So mm-hmm. If you don't self-police yourself, you know, or if you do, it's also a threat. And, the police are not very helpful. And there's been a great deal of violence, and I think even sexual assault by NYPD against women here in Occupy Wall Street. So,
Frank, you had a hand up, and I also wanted to ask the women from Oakland for the general strike on November 2nd. Right? You all put out a flyer addressing issues of why women are striking, and one of the things that is on it is a statement, "Police are not our friends. They do not keep us safe." So I wonder if any of you want to speak to the idea of having the police be involved in situations that might arise within the camps.
Occupy Oakland has, from its beginning, from before its beginning, been 100% anti-police. We never call the police. You know, it's no, like, that's not the way that we deal with our problems. And I would back up from the idea that we're policing each other. You know, I think that we're taking care of each other. And I think that's one of the reasons that Occupy Oakland has been so radical and so successful in many ways. Oh, maybe Cynthia, you want to take the question about the police?
Well, I think that for a long time now, the police has used women as an excuse to intervene in a number of things, and like one of the most present ones is the killing of Kenneth Harding that was justified by saying that he was a pimp, and in this way, you know, police were protecting women from this pimp, so...
Can you explain who Kenneth Harding was? Because I think people probably have forgotten about that incident.
Yes, he was a black man that was murdered by BART police for not paying for his fare ticket.
Right. No, wasn't it San Francisco police for not paying his muni ticket?
But basically, this excuse has been used over and over, and it's, you know, unacceptable. I myself have been sexually harassed by police officers, so I do not in any way, shape, or form feel safer when there is a police officer. I don't think that there is any reason why I would call a cop. It just doesn't seem logical to me, no matter what happens. Even in instances where people are raped, you know, the way that the police deal with it is it's horrible. It really is.
Sorry, I just wanted to address that. I'm sorry, I wasn't very clear about the self-policing here at Occupy Wall Street when I just mentioned it. What happened was before Safer Spaces became really strong, we did have a security team, which was comprised of pretty aggressive Marines, ex-Marines, and so what was going on was this kind of weird self-policing, and it was actually sometimes creating more trouble than the model that we proposed at Safer Spaces, which was de-escalation, mediation, and also, you know, accountability and ejection, but through, you know, working it out. So that's what I meant by...
Oh, okay. That's crazy. I didn't hear about these militarized policing at the beginning.
You know, they would be offended if I said that because they're comrades and they were defending, so they found themselves in a strange predicament. They weren't working with the police, but they were pretty aggressive.
I was going to say, some of us that have been working together in the Bay Area also really think that the issue of policing shows the complete, like, relation of race and gender, because it's as if the way that, like, racism is expressed and white supremacy is expressed through this arm of the state in the police is justified through the way that they are supposed to be protecting, quote-unquote, women. And so that shows that both the category of woman is raced and the category of the people that are supposed to be attacking women is also raced. And that this is really, you cannot divide that racialization from the way that we understand gender in general.
So you all talked about, you know, working on a system where we're protecting each other and someone who is violating our space or not respecting people is ejected from the camp. I'm wondering if you have actually seen it work, and if so, if you can be a little more specific about how that's accomplished.
Definitely. I think that some of the ways in which we try to not involve the police is by empowering each other, empowering ourselves, creating spaces to do this, arming ourselves, literally, learning self-defense, forming quote-unquote girl gangs, cop watching, intervening in acts of violence when it is happening.
I've seen and been part of several times at Occupy Oakland where a group of people went around to look for somebody who had been sexually assaulting other people and chanted them out. I've seen that it work twice very well. And I would emphasize, just because I think that the American imaginary assigns, like, race and gender representation to those two sides of a story, that it's not what one would assume, what like a sort of racist conception of things would assume. It's how it works at Occupy Oakland. It's not like, you know, that kind of a scene. And I've seen it work really well. The problem is, of course, that those people often come back. The people who are ejected often come back, and the issue of how to deal with them coming back is very difficult. And it really, I think, shows that there is really important to have a sort of like feminist queer occupation space, you know, which I think a lot of people around the country are talking about, that sort of space needing to be made.
This has also been thought of a lot outside of the occupation movement. I think that a lot of us have been thinking about this for a while, and I mean, I've encountered instances in which I definitely wanted to intervene in some way, and some of these tactics that I spoke about were used, and it did prove to be effective.
You are listening to Women's Magazine on KPFA 94.1 FM and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm speaking with Sin, Caitlin, and Frank from Occupy Oakland's Feminist and Queers Against Capitalism, and with Shaysta Hussain of the Occupy Wall Street Safer Spaces and Immigrant Workers Justice Working Groups. We'll take a short musical break and be back to talk about Hot Chicks of Occupy Wall Street and whether the slogan, "We are the 99%, really works for everyone.
United in the bed, we used to fight, but now we hold our heads up high, and you see us. We're feeling new. We're not that chained up little shopper still in love with you. Got us working to the bone, but today we're breaking free. Now we're saving all our loving for our community.
People critique, and specifically women feminists have critiqued the 99% idea as feeling like it kind of eradicates some of the differences, and that, yes, we're the 99%, yes, we're all in some ways oppressed in this society if we're not one of those 400 people who own 75% of the wealth, but we're not all oppressed in the same way. Caitlin, you've been kind of quiet, so I'm wondering if you want to speak to that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm really heavily against any rhetoric of the 99%. Like, I hate it because it seems like it doesn't address anything that matters to me. Like, I'm not super concerned with the bankers. I'm more concerned with, like, how the bank is going to take my house. Like, I don't really care about the bankers as much as I care about, like, being able to survive as, like, a person who has extreme difficulty getting a job because people look at me and look at my ID and can't make sense of me, and I turned into some weird tranny monster that, like, they don't want to hire. Like, none of this 99% rhetoric, like, speaks to, like, my class interests as a woman, a trans person, as a broke, precarious laborer.
Shaysta, maybe you would want to talk about if you've had some of those discussions in New York and how they've gone, you know, have people been receptive to that critique?
Well, there is a tendency to streamline our politics in terms of trying to win over some kind of mainstream or be popular, you know, so there's this concern for being very inclusive of Middle America. I mean, not everybody, but my thing is this. I've been watching the Arab Springs, and, you know, we are all Khalid Saeed. this meme, this 99% meme, or we are all Troy Davis, that then starts to make sense. We are all somebody who's been persecuted or executed, and when we identify, we build a movement around identifying with that person who, you know, with that injustice. So I think that's where that comes from. We are the 99%, but I think it's a bit of, I think it's a bit divorced from the original usefulness of that meme that was used in, say, Arab Spring. You know, a couple of times, you know, I even Zizek or a couple of academics have come and they speak about this class war against the capitalist and the rich and tend to put the whole movement as if it is some kind of post-feminist or post-racist movement, as if we've gone beyond, you know, these issues. So I think sometimes people want to, you know, if you bring up issues around race and gender and they don't, you know, if they're doing something, you know, they're, oh, well, that's a bit alienating. Okay, let's try to stay focused, or no, we have to concentrate on one issue. And actually, it defeats the purpose, because one of the other aspects to this Occupy movement has been a diversity of tactics. And if you don't have diversity, you can't really have a diversity of tactics, you know. So in some ways, it hasn't been as plural and diverse as it should be. If it was We Are All Troy Davis, then I understand that. But the 99% is a sort of co-optation, I don't know, reification of that.
Well, although isn't it partly a way of trying to broaden it out? And I mean, if we were only a movement for Troy Davis or for, you know, if we were only, I mean, we have for many years, honestly, I've been part of movements that were about trying to get people to identify with people who are worse off than them, and people don't.
Right.
So, like, this is, I don't think it's an accident that this is the first movement that's become really huge in a really long time, because everybody feels like it's about them. And in a lot of ways, I find that part of its beauty and its strength. I don't necessarily want to lose that, but at the same time, there needs to be a way of incorporating the multiple issues that bring us there, so that there are certain things that we all share, but there are certain things that we don't, and how do we balance that? Frank?
I wanted to say that I really agree with the comment from New York that the whole debate around the 99% is one about alienation. So, like, people want to embrace the 99% thing because they don't want to alienate anybody. And I think that the people who are sort of pushing a discourse around race and around gender are trying to say, when you try not to alienate anybody, you are alienating lots of people. So the attempt to smooth over the things that might scare some people is going to show a lot of people in the United States that the movement is irrelevant to them. And I think that that's why in Oakland, the fact that it started out being anti-police and anti-politician, or like being uninterested to talk to politicians, that, you know, I was talking to someone in my family the other day who was saying that's really alienating to some people. Like, some people, like, consider the police, like, you know, people who will take care of them and this, which is true. But I think that I think that it's a choice about who you're going to alienate. Like, there is no politics that doesn't alienate people. There's just a mythical blank politic that doesn't say anything. So technically it doesn't alienate anybody, but in not saying anything really specific, it's saying we don't care about racism, we don't care about patriarchy, and so on. And I think for me, the 99% slogan is weird because it doesn't actually even address class. It's just a weird percentage. And so, you know, I think that I really loved here in Oakland that there's been this masking chant that people have started, that whenever people start to chant, we are the 99%, people start to chant, we are the proletariat over it, which has the right amount of syllables. So I like that.
Wow, that's really great. But I think what we're trying to do is, with the anti-oppression work, is disalienate. We're already alienated, and addressing these issues is a process of disalienation. You know, without that, we're not. How can we come together? We'll just be autonomous, you know, separate and autonomous. And that's also another meaning of autonomous. It means separate. If you're autonomous, but you have solidarity, well, what are those principles of solidarity? And how do you frame your discourse, or how do you frame your politics where undocumented immigrants or people of color really, really believe that, you know, this is definitely their struggle and, you know, they're going to come and make it theirs, you know? So,
I mean, what about that? Is this an anti-capitalist movement? Are we the proletariat? Sin, what do you think?
I definitely view it as an anti-capitalist movement. I definitely think in Oakland it's viewed as an anti-capitalist movement. I don't know about other occupations. I don't feel that this has been emphasized as much as it has been here. But I think that, you know, reforming in some way capitalism is not beneficial at all. It would be highly problematic if this was the kind of course of action that this movement was taking, right? I mean, we've seen over and over that it's not working and that capitalism functions in this way, and it sort of depends on these crises. So reforming it in some sense would just be enabling the system to continue on exploiting people. It's never going to function without exploiting individuals. So I think it most definitely has to take an anti-capitalist stance.
Caitlin? I think that the Occupy movement has within it a lot of, like, because it is so, like, plural and broad, or at least in some places is very plural and broad, there are a lot of, like, anti-capitalist tensions within it. There's, like, anti-capitalist stuff going on. And I think what's really cool about Occupy Oakland is that the anti-capitalist content has been prioritized, like, from the get-go. Like, you have, like, actions like the general strike, which is nuts. Like, it's hard for me to believe that anybody actually did that, because, like, on paper, it's this, like, crazy radical thing to say we are going to shut down a, like, critical part of capitalist infrastructure for a period of time. In some ways, like, the outset, like, the framing of the Occupy movement isn't, like, anti-capitalist, and it isn't really, like, a movement of the proletariat. I think, like, you see in a lot of places, it really is just, like, white middle-class liberals.
Shasta, did you want to say anything about that, being that you're in New York?
Well, at the beginning, there were a lot of different groups. You know, there were the Ron Paul contingents. Because we were an open public space and we were about reclaiming public space and sort of creating a platform for conversation to begin, it was done in a way that, you know, what are your demands? It was like, we're not going to have demands. That was a big fight. And it was, let's just ask the question, what are your demands? Because the people, a lot of, at the beginning, I argue a lot of people of color are not here yet. They're not here. The people from Queens, my brothers and sisters who might not even speak English, who are most victimized, less systemic in this structure, they haven't arrived yet. So, let's hold up on the demands, or what are demands? We've done that in the past. That's a traditional left wing union. You know, these are our demands, and we didn't want it to be so economistic. We wanted it to be more political, and so obviously there's a huge contingent who wants demands. There are people who want to be the left wing of the Democratic Party. They're even some Ron Paul people. And some of us, I follow Egypt and Spain and Greece very carefully, because for a leaderless movement, I think our leadership is actually abroad. We have to be really careful. We have to watch carefully what's happening in Egypt right now. One of the strongest working groups at Occupy Wall Street has been the Labor Working Group, and these were some of the core people who've been working in New York City from CUNY for decades even, and within labor unions, within rank file, there are huge networks here that are forming. And the same thing with January 25th, Tahrir. It was January 25th, February 1st was the first general strike. So at the beginning, the general strikes were just spontaneous, huge movements of grassroots, of rank and file people,
And that sort of happened again this weekend with the election. So we are anti-capitalist movement, but how or what in terms of how are we going to, let's say, for example, we are evicted now. We don't have this occupation. It doesn't mean that all our networks are void. No, it means that we're going to take the occupation to the schools, to the universities, to foreclosed homes, and we're going to proliferate because the coalition and the network is still there.
I guess I do want to, well, I want to transition into talking about the future for a few minutes, but first I would be remiss if I didn't ask for a reaction to Hot Chicks of Occupy Wall Street. who wants to speak to that?
Yeah, that came up. And I guess there was a sister from Safer Spaces who wrote a blog, just a scathing critique of it. I guess he was the filmmaker who made that video. He was trying to recruit more heterosexual, you know. He felt there was a need to recruit more men, and that was the way to go.
Change we need.
Yeah, I'm sure all of you think that that's exactly what was missing from the movement was heterosexual men. Frank?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, what frustrated me about that whole, like, hullabaloo around that website was it, when I ended up looking at the website, it was sort of just like, okay, this is really dumb and exactly the kind of thing I am, like, absorbing whenever I'm at, when I was at Occupy Wall Street, it was really strong, and at Occupy Oakland, it's also really strong, that kind of a person. You can just feel them around, you know, it's totally normal. The guy should just get punched and ignored, like, whatever. But the fact that, like, that was what everyone then wanted to talk about in terms of, like, the bar of feminist analysis, like, where the bar was at, was what was really, like, disturbing and disappointing. And I think that there's just, also because of the whole slut walk, like, phenomena, there's been a lot of, like, the conversation and the discourse around patriarchy has been so banal and so about, like, how things are represented, how they're spoken about, like, what pictures are taken, you know, what signs are written. And while those things are important, their importance in my mind is dwarfed by the importance of, like, the actual, like, for example, gender division of labor globally and, like, what that means and how our lives hook into that gender division of labor and, like, the sex trade and, like, the situation of most, like, working women and women of color and trans people and et cetera, in America. Like, so I just feel like that was a really good example of how, like, all the feminist blogs, most of them, like, the mainstream ones, just wanted to talk about this website, this stupid dude, and it's kind of like, I don't care. I don't care about this stupid dude.
Well, guys, I mean, that was just one example, but there's, you know, a lot of there's MTV, they're doing a reality show. There's also Jay-Z, who's got his Occupy the Streets t-shirts. And so what you have is, you have a lot of mainstream Fox TV, you know, this kind of co-optation of the politics going on. And, you know, some would argue that, well, MTV appeals to teenagers who wouldn't otherwise be at the occupation, and it might have some value of bringing people in. And I disagree. I mean, I don't think that voyeuristic or mainstream, you know, Jay-Z making all this money, it completely waters down our politics. And
can you tell me, like, what are the material effects of that watering down?
Well, in a way, it kind of becomes a fad where, you know, it's, or somebody's making a profit off of it. And it's kind of like what happened in the 60s, or we had a serious sexual revolution, but at the same time, there was a backlash, and it was like, yeah, that, you know, these culprits and these sexually hedonistic people, and it all goes into discrediting us at the same time. Sexual freedom is a totally different thing than a voyeuristic guy. I guess this is what's going on with Alia in Egypt right now, who's stripped naked. I don't know if you guys have heard about that.
I didn't.
Oh, okay. Yeah, check it out.
she posted a nude photo of herself on a blog to really challenge the mainstream sort of moral policing. During the Tahrir, a lot of women were actually doing these virginity tests by the military. There was a lot of sexual harassment, enormous amount of sexual harassment.
But I think that what I mean is that what matters is how that is going to be taken up by people on the ground, in Tahrir Square, in wherever, you know? It's not the battle of spectacle against spectacle that matters.
Right.
What matters is, like, if it's affecting the world. And I think that most of the time, and maybe I should just speak for the United States, which is where I know, to try to battle spectacle, to battle Jay-Z's co-optation of it, or hot chicks on Wall Street, by critiquing those things and trying to create counter media against them, is not the way. That's just my opinion and my experience, that it's that's actually a distraction from, like, the more serious, like, fights that we need to, that we are waging. Do you know what I mean?
I agree with you, but it gives us an opportunity to critique that, and I think people have been taking up, you know, to create alternative media, which is going to be part of this alienation that I was talking about, which is an important tactic for consciousness and solidarity. And once people see that video, they'll also see a critique of it, you know, and I hope that they will. And that critique is necessary, you know, that's one of the fronts we have to fight, and we have to fight the media. In fact, when Bloomberg evicted us, he said, "Now you're going to fight with ideas," you know. So it's an ideological battle, and it's going to be important for us to articulate what it is that we don't like about the consumerism of our culture, of the alienation, of the voyeurism and the racism, and all these inherent, you know, the consciousness. So that's part of anti-oppression work.
You know, those sorts of things, the hot chicks on Wall Street or the JC shirts, were, you know, more than expected. Obviously, someone was going to try and capitalize off of this, etc. I just think that we shouldn't necessarily, you know, be reactionary and just waste our energy on constantly writing critiques of what others are doing, and instead, you know, write our own narrative of what we are striving for.
I agree with what Sin is saying, and I also think that, you know, the ideological front, you know, is important, but that I think we really need to realize that that is always what takes over. Like, historically, because, like, us academics and us writers and, like, tend to be the ones pushing for it and, like, creating the discourse most often, we start to think that that's the front that's, like, the most worthy of the most action, and not, like, the food and the taking buildings so people can live in them, and, like, growing food so people can sustain themselves, and, you know, like, defending ourselves against, like, the police officers that are killing people in these neighborhoods. So I just think that I agree that diversity of fronts is really important, but that, like, we have to realize that sometimes some get put above them tacitly, like, secretly.
So that sort of is a good segue into what I want to wrap up with, which is, what's the way forward? You know, most of the encampments have been evicted, unlikely, since it seems to be a coordinated effort of Homeland Security. It's pretty much a given that they're all going to be gone by within a couple of weeks, if not by the time the show airs. You know, what do you see as the next phase? What do you personally and your groups plan on being doing in the next few months? Sin?
I think that what we should be doing is still taking over spaces, but moving indoors. I definitely think that, as Frank was saying previously, we need to be meeting our material needs. And a way to do that is, you know, to move indoors, take over space, organize. And I think that a reason why we constantly keep getting raided is because this is in some way very effective. It's a threat, right? So, yeah, I think a lot of us are working towards that, towards taking over property and redefining what private property is seen as.
And do you see that happening? And I'm going to, Chase, I'm going to give you a chance to speak to that as well. But do you see that happening maybe on a smaller scale so that different groups might take over different spaces? And I mean, because one thing that I've definitely thought is, you know, if there wasn't one camp, it would be a lot harder for them. I mean, even in San Francisco where there were three, even though they were really near each other and two of them were tiny, it definitely created more of a problem for the police to control. And should we be looking for the women's occupation and the queer occupations and the trans occupations to be springing up around Oakland, New York, anywhere else?
Well, I don't know about any going on, but I would say that I hope that they happen. And everyone that I've talked to is talking about it. And I think that everyone listening to this should talk to some friends about an empty building that they've seen that can be used, because that's what is on the tip of everybody's tongue right now. And I think that certainly spaces organized around certain affinities are really a good idea, like political affinities, identity affinities.
Caitlin, did you want to jump in?
There is a chance here for everyone to kind of break off, separate based on like what Sin was talking about with material needs. Like there's a chance for this momentum that has been created, like against all odds, to like to move outwards and to like start addressing like more like of like, you know, just a huge diversity of things, because all we really have is like what we want, what we need to get.
So what do you see going on in New York? Is the conversation about the same, or is there other stuff that we haven't mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of demoralization, but there's also been mobilization in a different, with a different strategy or a different tactic. I've already noticed. The November 17th was so successful, even though it was 2 days after the eviction, was because we had been organizing it for a while, and, you know, the eviction also made more people come. But so one of the fears is, you know, is will our rallies become bigger or smaller? I mean, because when we first had, we had this occupation for 2 months, and we were giving out free food, free health care, free library, free education, free teach-ins. This idea of the free was, you know, a complete antithesis to Wall Street and the buildings around us. So the idea of the commons is, this is all our property, free education. We have a right to free health care, and not just, you know, Obama's health care, but the right for health care and big pharma to be out of medicine, to be non-profit so that we find cures. You know, we have a right to go against big agribusiness and have organic local food. We have the right for corporations not to pollute our waters, our airs, and, you know, our air. And some people took it really literally because they felt like the occupation, having this little park, Liberty, we could practice this experiment, but that's a bit, you know, is a bit shabby utopian idea. And I think now that, I think perhaps this idea has to take on a national level where we really move towards the commons. One of the things that I'm going to do, some of us are doing now in the Solidarity for Egypt, is that we're going to have protests at these arms firms, you know, that are making the tear gas, and we're going to the Egyptian consulate. We're going to try to go to the Bloomberg building instead of Gracie Mansion or City Hall. We were occupying Wall Street. Now we're going to continue occupying Wall Street. So we're going to take this to their doorstep, and it might even be a better tactic than to be in this fairy tale little Liberty Square. It might be a good thing what has just happened, you know, to mobilize us further.
Frank, did you want to let people know about a few specific things coming up?
I would just be remiss to ignore the amazing endeavor, which is a West Coast port shutdown being organized for December 12th. ILWU members, Occupy Oakland organizers from all up and down the West Coast are working on this right now, and it's really exciting. And obviously, as feminists, a lot of us are wondering, like, we're really involved in organizing it, and how can we, like, also connect this in some way to a critique of patriarchy, which is a difficult thing, but an important question to even ask in the midst of this really cool thing. And maybe you guys in New York are also going to shut down a little bit of port over there.
I have been talking with Sin, Frank, and Caitlin from Occupy Oakland and Shasta Hussein from Occupy Wall Street. Thank you all so much for taking so much time. And this has been a really engaging and lively discussion. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope you have. And I hope to speak with you all again soon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Some great websites to check out for more feminist and womanist analysis of the Occupy movement are OccupyPatriarchy.org, WomenOccupy.tumblr.com, and RadicalHub.wordpress.com. And we'll, of course, have those links for you on our website, which is kpfawomensmag.blogspot.com.
You just heard Kate Raphael's interview with Shaisa Hussein of Occupy Wall Street's Safer Spaces and Immigrant Justice Working Groups, and Sin, Caitlin, and Frank from Occupy Oakland's Feminist and Queers Against Capitalism. This interview was recorded in 2011.